Through the Blackwater bayous and in the dark Louisiana night floats a duck camp, alive with the sounds of swamp pop and the smells of Cajun cooking. From the Mississippi Delta in Venice to the Cajun prairies of the Southwest, me and the Duck Camp Dinners crew will be hunting and eating it all.
This is Duck Camp Dinner.
Join me, Chef Jean-Paul Bourgeois, and the whole crew every Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, because you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Harvest Nature's Wild Fishing Game Podcast. You get your host here, Justin Townsend, alongside my compadre, Adam. Hey. Excited to chat today a bit. We're going to continue on with our Cooking by Cut segment. And today we're going to be discussing the ribs and the brisket. They are very connected pieces. Literally and metaphorically, so we'll talk about those today. In our next Cooking by Cut episode, we will stay within the sort of the center portion of the animal, and we'll talk about the skirt and flank steaks. So that'll be an exciting episode. First off, I guess we'll go through a bit of current events, kind of what's going on in our world. We're in sort of the tail end of hunting season here is we're in January. Also, it's our first recorded episode of the new year. We haven't released any yet, so we're getting back on track. We got a new podcast producer coming in to help us out as well, coming here very soon. His name's Cody. So we'll bring him in and introduce him at some point and see where it all goes. And other than that, let's see, goose hunting. So it's been pretty frigid here in Colorado over the last week. It dipped down into the very, very low negatives. And I decided it was a great idea to take my daughter out goose hunting. So we went out to some of this youth-only blinds, which are about 20 minutes from my house, and it was negative 11 there Fahrenheit. I don't know what that is in regular Celsius, the rest of the world. But it was cold, and I took my daughter, who's 11, and she braved the cold. One morning sit and one afternoon sit, and we saw tons of geese everywhere. We couldn't really get them to fly into our spread, though, so that was a little frustrating. And then, of course, the cold. The first day, our heater ran out, and we were just kind of sitting there. It wasn't too bad for me, and then it started getting cold a little later, but Zoe felt as though she wasn't adequately prepared with gloves and all that other stuff, so she was pretty frigid. And then we had to pack up all the decoys from the field, which took about 30 minutes, and you're like, really, you're out of the blind and exposed to the elements, and so she was not feeling that. But we moved through. We'll probably go back out. I think the blinds are open until I think the 7th of February or something like that is when we can still hunt them. So we'll correspond up into our goose camp, which actually this is also the first episode I've talked about our goose camp. So we canceled our waterfowl camp that we had in Oklahoma, which was January. It actually would have been this week, right, Adam?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah, so it would have been this week. So we canceled that and decided instead that we are going to have a snow goose camp in February. So it is February 15th through the 18th in Mound City, Missouri. which if you've ever seen pictures of like the hundreds of snow geese flying, that's those photographs are taken from like a preserve, which is in Mound City. So it's like the epicenter for kind of the snow goose migration in that area, which is pretty cool. So we're partnering with a local lodge there, and we'll be out in the goose pits hunting those. The great thing about snow geese is that there are no daily limits. There's no bag limits. There's none of that. It's like free for all. You don't have to have a plug in your shotgun. You can just go crazy. You can use electronic calls. Like, it's pretty wild. The cost of the license is only $45, which is great. And you just go there and you just blast it. But we're going to approach it very similar to how we have our wild pig camp, where we're going to run you through shooting, through the hunting, through the butchering, and the cooking. So right now it's just going to be Adam and I. We've got a total of 8 people signed up. We have one more seat left. So if you're hearing this and you're interested, you should come and join this really awesome event. And we are going to do a lot more, I think, food-focused stuff. Adam and I are a little elevated cuisine with the snow goose to try and make it a little more, not fun, it's fun always, but I don't know, make it exciting, do something different. So we're going to do that. We got some skeet shooting lined out, and then, of course, tons of birds to clean, hopefully. This big, like, Arctic exposure of coldness will hopefully push some snow geese down, which will be good. So we'll stay tuned for that. But we'll probably also do a podcast while we're there. I'm planning on it. So that'll be fun to talk about goose hunting whilst goose hunting, maybe. But we'll see how that goes. And let's see, other than that, pretty much just like trying to cook. Adam and I are working on a project together, cranking out a ton of recipes and doing some fun stuff. We'll tell you all about it soon, but until then, it's super secret squirrel stuff. And then I'll turn it over to Adam. Adam, what you got, buddy?
Not a whole lot going on since December. Just kind of recovering from Christmas and New Year's and everything. But I am going rabbit hunting this weekend. Which will be probably the last hunt we can do here in Ontario before the whole everything kind of shuts down. And oddly enough, I've never been rabbit hunting. I got into hunting late in life, and I figured that rabbit hunting would be one of the first things I did for some reason. I don't know if that's because of Bugs Bunny or some something in my brain told me that was the first thing to kind of start out with was rabbit hunting, and I've never had the chance to actually do it. And the places I do see a lot of rabbits are not places I should be blasting away with the shotgun, I don't think. So I finally got the chance to do that this weekend with a buddy on his parents' farm, so I'm really looking forward to that, trying something new. So I think we'll be probably hunting on snowshoes because we got a couple feet of snow recently. So yeah, it's been pretty deep. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. And then other than that,
it's like a bucket list for me, hunting snowshoes on snowshoes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I don't know, I'm sure we get a few snowshoes down here, but we might be more likely hunting cottontail and maybe European hare, but we'll have to see. Don't know too much about it, but my buddy is much better informed. He also recently got his trapper's license, and we'll be cooking up some muskrat, which I haven't tried cooking it before. So, yeah, I'm pretty excited about this weekend. Other than that, I've just been, like I said, preparing for snow goose camp and cranking recipes and cooking up a storm, but I haven't been doing any fishing or hunting really this month yet.
Well, definitely wish you luck as you go on your first rabbit hunt. I think rabbits was one of those things we hunted pretty like frequently when we were kids growing up. And it was often, I always loved it whenever it snowed because then you could track the rabbits. And so granted, in Oklahoma, we didn't get a ton of snow. But whenever it did, because then you could go out and you could track them and follow them. And usually we'd be much more successful otherwise. But we also had this thing too. They said growing up, like, don't eat rabbits before the first freeze. So you typically wouldn't hunt them very often until just during the winter. So I don't know. Do you guys have that? Is it a kind of a saying where you're at?
I haven't heard it as much, but is that because of worms and disease?
That was the speculation was parasites. But it's like when I lived in California, we would hunt rabbits year round. Like there's no season on them. There's no bag limit. You can go crazy. Or maybe there is. It's like 5 or 6 a day, which is a lot. But we never had any problems. Like I never found any, you know, worms, never found any parasites or anything like that in the ones that we hunted. So that was pretty cool to see the contrast just between the two. But curious to hear back after your hunt. Let me know how it goes. But let's go ahead and dive into sort of the meat of the show here. And I mentioned earlier we're going to talk about the ribs and the brisket. So we'll start off with the ribs. And, you know, I think the ribs are one of those cuts, like if you were to ask somebody to point to a cut of meat and identify what it was, I would guess that 95% of the people would identify the rib cut. So we'll break it down just like we do for all these cuts. And so really, the ribs are the curved bones that form the lateral thoracic walls of the animal. So that's like your rib cage area. So those ribs are the outside pieces. They are attached at the top to the spine, and then down at the bottom of the rib, depending on where they're placed on the animal, they may either be connected or they may be free-floating. Some of those ribs are going to be connected to the sternum by meat and cartilage. And then I mentioned others are free-floating, so those would be the ones back. And those would be the ones that you're most interacting with if you're, like, trying to open up the gut cavity without sort of, like, splitting the sternum. I think is where people are probably interacting with them the most. The portion that we are most concerned about as people who enjoy tasty meat is the portion between the ribs. And so this portion is called the intercostal space. So that'll be the region between each bone. And that is where the intercostal muscle lies. That's the meat. So that's what we want to eat. And depending on where it's situated, either the top of the ribs or the bottom of the ribs will determine what that those cuts are called, but it'll also determine some characteristics you'll get from that meat. And I'll go into that in just a second. I thought it was interesting that when we think about game animals and even domestic animals, that cows, deer, elk, and bear all have 13 ribs per side, whereas pigs and pronghorn antelope have 15 per side. So just a little difference, interesting fun fact. It'd be a good trivia question, actually. So I thought that was cool. But you will commonly see cuts of beef. Like when they're referring to quarters, they're counting the specific ribs and then they're cutting the whole hanging carcass in half to then split it down that based on a number of ribs. When we're in the wild game world, while you can cut animals that way, certainly, you're not going to see it cut as much. Most of the time, you're just going to see the quarters removed off and then the rib portion itself removed off. They're both located on each side of the spine. It's no surprise if you've seen an animal before. It's pretty uniform on each side. And then if you want to remove those, really there's two methods that you can do it. And I'm a big fan of batoning, and so that's where you're taking the meat cleaver and you're placing it with the basically kind of parallel to the spine. I guess it would be parallel. Yep. No, perpendicular. Okay. Parallel to the edge. Yeah, parallel to the edge of the spine with it being perpendicular to the rib. And you're taking your meat cleaver and you're tapping the back of it with a rubber mallet or a wooden mallet or whatever, usually rubber. And it's going to kind of travel along the edge of the spine and split the ribs off of the spine. You can also do that with a saw. You'll see a lot of people do it with like sawzaws or a hand meat saw. I don't like it as much because you end up with more bone particles than when you baton. And I actually find that batoning is less effort than sawing, unless you're using a sawzaw.
The size of the animal sometimes makes a difference. So doing things like deer or wild pigs, or if I'm doing domestic lamb or pigs, I'll stick to batoning. But once you start getting to like bison or moose or beef or stuff like that, then it takes a lot of muscle to tap that cleaver through. So then working with the saw might be a better option.
Luckily, I have a lot of muscle. So. Yeah,
you don't have to worry about that.
No, that's fair. I didn't even cross my mind, too. I'm sure like elk would be a little bit of more challenge. You're getting something bigger bodied as well. So, and then once you have that section of rib off, I try to do one side of an animal and then flip it over and do the other side of the animal, meaning like the quarters, removing the quarters, removing everything. But you could certainly like remove one rib section, flip it over, remove the other, and have two side by side. But I'll often finish one before I move to the next. And then I will take the whole rib cage on one side, and I will split it down the middle lengthways. So you end up with two long portions. And that's what you really commonly see. When you're shopping in the grocery store and you see beef or pork cuts, you've got your baby back ribs are the top portion of the ribs, which are closest to the spine. Those are usually meatier. And then you've got your spare ribs, which are your portion at the bottom, which are typically less meat but more flavor. And then you've got your rib tips, which is that section of meat between the lower end of the spare rib and the sternum. So that's that portion. So those are the three primary portions of the ribs. In wild game, depending on the size of your animal, you may not get rib tips for sure, because there's not a lot of fat or muscle kind of present there. It may be super thin. And you may often just want to keep those sort of that area attached to the sternum as part of your whole rib section, so you can really cook and utilize that meat. Once I split them in half, I typically will break them into usable sections. So usually like four or five ribs per section. I feel like that's an adequate serving. Like if you're going to serve someone, is to have that. We'll talk a little bit about the meat thickness real quick, but so when we're going to talk about brisket here in a minute, part of that brisket's going to be the meat on the outside of the ribs. So if you take that off, you're going to end up with a much thinner rib, which I think is okay. But if you leave that portion of the brisket on, you're going to end up with more meat. It just really comes down to personal preference of what you want to do. So that's just a little food for thought. You're welcome. The jokes are free.
You know that you said that you like to break them up into about five ribs or so. In a grocery store or restaurant setting, five or more ribs constitutes a rack. So if you're getting a rack of ribs, if you get less than five bones on it, it's not a true rack of ribs, apparently. Another little factoid I learned today in researching this.
Nice. That's good to know, too, because then if you get a half rack, then you'd be getting like two or three
ribs,
which would be kind of disappointing.
Yeah.
So that actually translates well over into the culinary history bit a bit. So most people, I think, if you talk about like cooking ribs, at least most people in the States are going to think about like pit roasting or slow roasting ribs in like American barbecue style, right? Historically, you think about like plantations, you think about the Deep South, you think about that sort of connection to pork that folks have there. But ironically enough, that's not where you find the origins of the popularity of cooking ribs. Sure. People have for a long time consumed and eaten ribs, but I will say that in the way that we see it today is relatively new, not as new as some of the cuts that we've talked about that are like from, oh, this cut was invented in the 1990s. But I would say the early 1900s, you had the creation of the ribs as a useful and popular cut due largely to industrial butchering practices. And what happened was as the animals were getting broken down and going into barrels to store, they couldn't store the full carcasses in the barrel. So they would break the ribs off, and the ribs would then easily fit in barrels for storage. Am I getting right that? Am I getting that right, Adam? Am I missing anything?
Yeah, I think they could pack the majority of the pig into the barrel, but the ribs, due to their size, wouldn't fit properly into the barrel, so they were left out from shipping. That's how I read it. Anyways. Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense, right? If you're trying to fit a whole section of a pig in there and you've got this last thing, probably the last cut you're going to put in is like, well, we don't really use this. All these other cuts are much popular, so let's get them to the markets and then we'll have this left over. Well, and then in turn, it's like, well, then they started selling them and using them, and then it became a staple in cuisine. So I think that that's a cool little evolutionary tale. But
It's much like chicken wings, or there's some other cuts too that were very unpopular in the past and were basically like a throwaway item. So they didn't fit in these barrels. The barrels got shipped. They were left over with these ribs. They basically gave them away for next to nothing. Poor communities would then rely on those cuts for their meat, because that was the only meat they could afford compared to the rest of the stuff. And then they eventually became part of the cultural identity, and then that they somehow became popular once more, just like ribs and chicken wings have, and now they're expensive as hell again. So it kind of full circle from it.
Oh, and they're so tasty too. I'm a big rib fan. Mm-hmm. Well, ribs and wings, now that we mention it. But I, too, like, my mind definitely goes towards, like, American-style barbecue of, like, going and getting ribs and slow-cooking them over the smoker, then slathering them with barbecue and just devouring them as quickly as I can. And like I mentioned earlier, I think that's probably where a lot of folks' heads are at. The big difference with wild game, though, is that you lack, there's no fat, or as Adam mentions as well, there's bad fat. And so what do you mean when you say bad fat?
So that's kind of a general term, but it's a fat that most people don't want. So if you're thinking of like nice, juicy, succulent pork ribs, and you know, that fat kind of just melts into the meat and it keeps everything super moist. And when you take a bite out of it, it just kind of melts in your mouth. You generally don't get that with fat from cervids, which we've talked about before. And that's due to like a high concentration of saturated fat and stearic acid, which is something that basically coats your mouth. And most people who've eaten a lot of venison have had that sensation before, where you eat a fatty piece of venison, your mouth gets coated with like a chalky kind of sensation. Funny enough, funny enough, the stearic acid in the saturated fat that's causing that fatty acid is can be found in beef and can be found in lamb and goat, and you'll notice that a little more in beef and lamb and goat than you would in pork. But the other place it's found is in chocolate, which gives us that beautiful, luscious mouthfeel of chocolate that coats your mouth. Except venison fat's not going to leave you as happy as chocolate does. So,
speak for yourself.
I say bad fat, but I do kind of like a little bit of it. And if you treat it properly, which we'll get into later, I think it can be you can have a little bit on and you can enjoy it. But most people are more likely to want to get rid of it altogether. It's not going to be the same as pork.
One, too, we talk about, pork, like pork lard. So, like, rendered fat from pork is lard. And then you've got, like, from cervids and stuff, even cervids and then cattle, lamb, all that would be tallow. So it wouldn't, you wouldn't have the same expectation as a lard from a tallow. It's still useful in the culinary world, just understand the differences. So yeah, so you'll get that present there of either lack of fat or the fat that you may not want to consume. So that's going to tell you, you're not going to want to slow smoke it a ton because you're going to dry it out. And the point of slow smoking it is to get it to take a very tough cut because it's on the outside of the animal. It's doing a lot of work. It's holding up. It's moving. It's getting poked and prodded. And it's there to protect really the inside vital organs of the animal. And so it's going to be kind of tough and chewy. And in order to break it down, you're going to need to, as we see, like with domestic animals, slow smoke it, which slowly cooks it. Or I think in the case of wild game, you're going to want to braise it or slow cook it and maintain some kind of moisture content. And we'll talk a little bit about that technique in our recipes. And we've got a few favorites of preparation methods, but it's real easy to braise, sous vide, and then finish, you know, with a sear or a grill to get sort of that like characteristic char that you think of when you think about kind of barbecued ribs. Did I miss anything, Adam?
I don't think so. Another thing to contend with wild game is the age of the animal, which can sometimes be much older than an animal you're getting from the grocery store, sometimes by years. So you're going to have to cook it longer in order to tenderize it. And if there's less fat and you're cooking it longer, there's even more opportunity for it to dry out on you. So cooking, like you said, braising with a liquid or with moisture is extremely important. It doesn't have the fail safes and buffers that a young fatty animal from the grocery store has.
You could probably even like, if you were really set on some sort of like grilling or smoking, if you like basted regularly and kept it closed so you could seal in moisture, you could probably get away with that, but you're definitely going to see a bit of drying out from like very prolonged dry heat cooking.
I'm Will Cooper, host of HuntStand's Make Your Mark podcast. For even more content, be sure to watch the original films from HuntStand Presents on the Waypoint TV channel every Tuesday at 10 p.m. Eastern. Visit waypointtv.com to learn more.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for the Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
But yeah, let's move over to talk a little bit about the brisket. So we've touched on the ribs. Now let's move to the other section here. So with the brisket, really what we're referring to is going to be a combination of two areas on the animal. So in cattle, it's much larger, it's much thicker, there's a lot of fat present, and in game, there's not. It's generally a pretty thin, I wouldn't say stringy, but grainy piece of meat, and really two portions. So you've got your front brisket or the breast, and then, which is also called the point. So that would be the portion underneath the neck, and atop the breastbone. That would also be known as like your pectorals of the animal. And then you've got your portion that runs underneath the shoulder blade and then atop the rib cage. And that is what I call like the belly, the rib flap. I think another, the more common or more professional cut is called the flat. And that would be the flat portion of meat there. It's full of connective tissue. There's a lot of silver skin on both sides. It's very thin. So in order to remove that silver skin, you would have to do a lot of trimming. I don't know, Adam, you want to go into this a bit?
Yeah, the it is likely to have some fat and potential fat pockets that you might want to remove, especially out of cervids. If we're talking about wild hogs, you can leave the fat. Elk, deer, moose kind of thing, you want to remove most of it. You know, trim the silver skin as much as possible. The grain of the meat is a lot like flank steak. If you've seen flank, you'll notice there's long, visible grains with the meat compared to kind of a shorter one. That often leads to toughness. You want to... you can kind of like remove it whole by peeling away with a knife underneath, getting your knife underneath and following the ribs, like the rib bones. Get it, peel it back and roll it up, and you can take off pretty much the whole thing from under the shoulders all the way around the protrusion of the chest or the breast and to the other side. Or you could cut it off in pieces, in separate pieces, depending on what you're doing with the animal. It's going to be a fair bit chewier than other cuts. It's going to be quite thin, and it's going to cook up very differently compared to your beef brisket. It's going to lack that fat cap that protects it during cooking. And it's going to lack the thickness and the intramuscular fat that keeps it moist while cooking. I'm sure everyone's had a dry brisket before too, so even a beef brisket can be prone to drying out, and a wild game brisket is even more so. So it's a tricky cut of meat, but it is a rewarding one if you treat it properly, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I think probably like one of the ways that I've been experimenting with it recently is like the rouladen, like the rolling it, and then kind of braising it in a liquid very slow to where it's you don't have to worry about trimming the silver skin as much, because you're cooking it to a point where the silver skin is going to, that fascia is going to turn to collagen, and you're going to get just that inside your liquid versus inside the meat, and which will allow it to be super tender as though all those connective tissues break down. So, it's kind of a good way to do it. We want to talk, let's see, a little bit about, you want to talk about the Old Norse word? Do you have it handy?
Oh, yeah. So there was the word brisket, which it's a little different than the rest of the animal. And I've always kind of thought that the cut didn't sound the same as the rest of the cuts on an animal. But it comes from an old Germanic word that means cartilage. And that goes to show how much connective tissue is found in this cut. And it comes off that breastbone. We're going to pull a lot of like your short ribs from beef or breast of lamb. And there's a lot of, and even those like kind of spare ribs like you mentioned before. You get a lot of like that cartilage in that section of the animal. So that must be where that comes from. So this was a cut that's been known for a long time, apparently, and it's been cooked, and people knew its properties for a long time as well.
And then, as we see it in more modern cuisine, I think I saw, I forget, I lost the article, I had it up, but it was smoked brisket or roast briskets, its origins we see in Jewish cuisine. Cooked during some of the holidays, which I thought was super cool, because also like the ribs, a lot of folks think Texas barbecue when you think about briskets. And so in the latter part of the 1800s, early part of the 1900s, probably the same point in which the ribs were growing in popularity, the briskets in the Texas ranchers kitchen was growing in popularity. So it then became sort of like a staple amongst Texas cuisine. I definitely love a good brisket. I think that wild game brisket's treated definitely a little differently. So, and then Adam, you mentioned a little bit about Asian cuisine. You want to talk some about that?
Sure. It's brisket. You just see it pop up in certain cuisines. It's not something that's kind of found everywhere, I've found. But one place you do see it is in a lot of Asian soups, which is interesting. So if anyone's ever had Vietnamese pho, the nice, tender, fatty cut in there is brisket. Hong Kong-style beef noodle soup has brisket. Some of the other Chinese soups. And that's a really cool place to find it because you find they've been like slowly simmered until they're super tender. And the, like we've said over and over in this podcast series, is that cuts with a lot of connective tissue have a lot of collagen, which turns into gelatin, which turns into mouthfeel and lip-smacking feeling and lots of flavor. So if you can imagine simmering a brisket, your broth is going to be extra flavorful, and you really do find that in Asian soups. They're like super hearty and full of umami and really flavorful. And yeah, can't get enough of them.
So very tasty. But as we talk about cooking, we've talked sort of about the braise, we've talked about the smoke, we've talked about the stuff and roll. It can definitely be shredded, right? So when you think about dishes where you're cooking it still, you're braising it essentially into a form where you can just sort of like pull it apart in these long shreds. And that's great for like tacos or, you know, served over rice or with some sort of starch and a delicious sauce. Like that's pretty much how you could do it. I mean, I would even see like if you want to shred it and have barbecue sandwiches would be super really tasty. Jeez, it would be very tasty. And then Adam, you mentioned a trim, sear, and medium to medium rare. What walk me through that.
It's like I mentioned, the grains are similar to a flank steak, which is often a thinner cut, and you can kind of treat this like the brisket tip or point the same way. So that what you're pulling off of the actual breastbone more so than the meat pulled from under the shoulders on the ribs. You can trim it well if you're able to, and because it's so thin, it takes well to marinades. Marinades often don't do much for meat because they only penetrate like a millimeter or two in, or whatever that is for
an eighth to a quarter of an inch.
Yeah, very little into the meat. But if you have a very thin cut, think if you're getting an eighth of an inch from both sides on a thinner cut, you're actually penetrating quite deep into the meat. So an overnight marinade and then a really quick sear, a really hot, fast sear. So you're going to be eating it like rare to medium rare with a nice crispy crust on the outside, much like a skirt steak or a flank steak. And that's an interesting way of eating it too. It's going to be a little chewier, but it's going to be flavorful and something a little different. So that's worth trying too. You could do some classic preparations using something like that. It would be like fajitas. You want it like super hot and fast. You want to sear it. You want a little char on there. You want to marinate it for a while, and then you can chop it up and throw it into tacos or fajitas or whatever. So that's like an interesting, unique way to use it.
Like carne asada.
Yeah, exactly. Good. Yeah.
Ooh, man, that sounds good. No, I think that's all really great. I was thinking too, sort of a tip for that is you want to make sure you're like slicing across the grain too, because then you're shortening those strands of meat, so it makes it easier to chew, because the longer the strand, the more chewy it is. So if you're cutting across the grain, you're going to shorten that, and it'll make it more pleasant to consume.
I said it in one of the other ones, but I'll say it again just to hammer it in. But picture have like a string, like a butcher's twine, and taking like a foot long piece and trying to chew on it, or a little half inch piece, and which one's going to be easier to chew and swallow? And you can picture that in the same way as these meat greens. You want to shorten them, then they're much easier to chew and to swallow. You're not just sitting there chewing on a wad of meat forever.
Exactly, exactly. Nobody likes that. Well, I don't know. Somebody probably does.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So let's talk a little bit about some recipes here, and we'll start with a rib recipe. And so this one's from our very own website by our very own Mr. Brandon Dale, who is a senior staff writer over at Harvesting Nature. And he's got a savory venison barbecue ribs recipe. And just upon initial inspection, this recipe meets the visual appealing quality that I like. It's nice and saucy. It looks roasted. You can see a little bit of bone. It looks super tasty. So I'll go with that. It's actually voted for 5 stars by someone. So Brandon does glaze this with barbecue sauce at the end. That's why we see such a yummy appearance. And he mentions too in this article very much what we talked about the venison ribs being very present with that tallow, the waxy fat we mentioned earlier. And a lot of people just will cut this off and throw it in the grind pile. I will say though that with this is that backcountry hunts where you're not able to bring home the whole animal, I will still go in and cut out rib meat. It's really easy to go in to those sections between the ribs and cut that meat off and add it to your grind pile if you're not willing or able to haul, you know, what is probably a ton of extra weight out of the field. So don't fret. Just cut it off and save it. Enjoy it. It'll go great in your grind. Or save it as like a braised type meat. You know, as we mentioned here, you could keep those big long sort of rectangle sections and throw that in its own separate bag and braise that down and use it for other things other than grind if you really wanted to. One thing too I wanted to mention earlier is a lot of folks will talk about the appearance of like that waxy tallow as they're cooking in there. And people have asked me before, I'm sure Adam, they've asked you as well, of like, how do I get rid of that? And so while you'll want to braise on the braise in like a container, a pot, finishing it on the grill will allow some of that waxy fat, if it is present, to sort of like render off and then melt away from the ribs themselves. So that's something to sort of think about. But in Brandon's recipe, he uses a full rack of venison ribs, uses a ton of spices, very akin to what you would see to a barbecue spice blend, which I think is great. You could also substitute two of our blends, I would say, at Harvesting Nature would be really good for it. One, the Big Game blend is always a great choice, but our waterfowl blend, because it's got like big, bold, like chop house flavors. I think that would go really, really well on a rack of ribs. And then he creates his own barbecue sauce using Sweet Baby Ray's, but then also adds in some whiskey or dark rum, garlic cloves. He uses stone fruit preserves, some paprika, garlic powder, onion powder, and black pepper. And how does he do this? Let's see. So he bakes the ribs on a baking sheet, wraps them in foil for 2 hours, then takes them off for 2 hours at 250 Fahrenheit, and then creates the sauce, and then he does exactly that. He does grill them on the ribs for just probably like 8 to 10 minutes on each side while basting with the sauce. And yeah, looks pretty tasty. I agree. Pretty good. So I'd recommend that. The link will be down in the show notes, as with all these. Do you want to talk about the next one there, Adam?
Sure. First, I just want to get into that a little bit with the it's like Brandon's recipe is a great way if you're getting into ribs for the first time and you're trying out your venison ribs. That is one of the best ways to get rid of that fat that we're talking about, because it's you're rendering it twice, basically. You're rendering it while braising, that fat slowly coming out into your braising liquid, and then you're rendering the rest of it over the grill, which is dripping into the grill and leaving the ribs, which is great. But that braising liquid that you started out with, one good method to get the fat out of it, because now that braising liquid is full of fat, it's also full of flavor and meat juices, which you don't really want to lose. You can put it into the fridge for a couple hours, and the fat will all rise to the top and solidify. You can then take the liquid out of the fridge and just pull basically the whole fat cap right off the top, and then you have like a fatless braising liquid. So don't throw out that liquid. Separate the fat, and you can reduce it into a sauce or cook it rice with it or save it in the freezer for a soup or something. So that's pretty valuable stuff, so don't lose it. Talk about braising again. I'm going with a Hank Shaw recipe, actually, who knows what he's talking about. This is a recipe for Italian braised venison ribs. He's basically taking a rack of venison ribs, and he's using something called saba or purple grape juice, and reducing it down and using that as a flavoring element in the recipe, which is interesting. So he's taking a Dutch oven, he's going to fry some bacon into it, render that fat out, and then brown the ribs in the bacon fat. He's then going to add like a sofrito of minced vegetables. It's usually like carrots, celery, onions, as well as some dried porcini mushrooms and tomato paste. And he's going to brown those as well. That's a great trick, by the way, for people who want to add more flavor to their meals. If the recipe calls for tomato paste, saute it a little bit before you add liquid. That's going to add some more Maillard reaction and lots of browning, and it's going to add a lot more flavor.
I've become too a bigger fan of the tomato paste in the tube versus mm-hmm. the tomato paste in the can.
Me too. I just have tubes all over the place.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, I love it. Because often you're like, oh, a teaspoon of or a tablespoon of mm-hmm. tomato paste, and you're opening a whole damn can, and then you like feel bad about throwing it out, so you put but you also don't want to transfer it into a Tupperware, then you put the can in the fridge. I don't know if you ever did that. Then it sits yep. there for 2 days, and you're like, oh, this is stupid. I'm just going to throw this out. If you have a tube, yep. it's usually a better quality product, and you can just squeeze out a tablespoon like toothpaste and then put it back in the fridge, and it's good to go for another, forever, basically. So, yeah, stop it with the cans unless you need a lot of it. Just go to the tubes. It's well worth your time. Anyway, so you're browning your venison ribs and your sofrito and your tomato paste, and then you're going to add some red wine in that grape juice that you've reduced, as well as some balsamic vinegar, and you're going to just braise that. And you're probably going to braise it for, 2 to 4 hours, depending on how large or old or what species the ribs are from. Some younger deer might only take 2 hours, where like a moose or an elk might take 4. Then you're going to gently remove the ribs from the pot. And in this case, you're not going to actually sear them or anything, or or grill them after, it's going to just remain kind of like a hearty, think of like a braised short rib with gravy on mashed potatoes kind of thing, or polenta. You're going to basically reduce that cooking liquid down and drench the ribs in that hot sauce over like some, like I said, mashed potatoes or polenta, and it's going to be like super rich, hearty winter meal. That's going to be kind of a nice change from all the kind of barbecue or grilling style recipes I usually find with ribs.
No, that sounds, yeah, that sounds really tasty. I'll talk to, I grew to be a fan in probably one of the first few ways. Well, there's like a very vintage recipe on Harvest and Nature website of me just trying to barbecue ribs, which does not always turn out great. And you end up with like this charred mess. But if you want to go see that disaster, it's still up. We'll probably have to change that. But I think, and you'll hear this one so commonly referenced, I think on like a lot of the social media groups, is Steve Rinella's Wild Game Ribs. And I think he follows a very similar path to what Hank Shaw does, and what we've talked about here is like braising, but then he does finish them on the grill. But instead of just braising, he actually puts the ribs into a pressure cooker. So instead of like braising for a long period of time, you're using using a pressure cooker to do this in about 20 minutes, and which will cut time as well. I've also seen this recipe done in a crock pot, not in 20 minutes though, but in like a 4 period as well. I think is another good way to do it if you don't want to do like a stovetop braise or an oven braise. You could certainly use some of those kitchen gadgets, like a pressure cooker, to do that. And then once you're done, you're gonna throw them on the grill and just combine all your stuff for your sauce. I think Steve uses a pretty basic dry rub on the outside, and then what he's calling his mop sauce is more of like a Carolina based, where he's using like a cider vinegar and yellow mustard on the outside to glaze that as it's cooking on the grill. So I think that's like pretty straightforward. I think if you're a cooker of ribs, or if you have not yet enjoyed ribs, these are probably three methods that can get you there. What's up?
I just had one more thing to talk about before we move on to brisket. Can't help myself. But I meant to mention it earlier, but we said that whole bad fat, we talked about this fat. Most people want to remove it, but I don't always want to remove it. I kind of like deer fat. And one of the tricks to... I don't find that it tastes that gamey. It might depend on the deer, like where you got it, whether it's like a cedar swamp deer versus a corn-fed deer or whatever. But for the most part, I don't like removing all the fat from my deer. One trick in order to eat the fat and enjoy it is to eat it very hot. So if you're planning on leaving a little more fat in your ribs, if you eat it really hot, it's going to be actually quite nice. It's not going to coat your mouth the same way. It's going to be quite flavorful. It's going to be more tender and unctuous, more like a pork or beef rib, or more like actually a lamb rib if you've ever had that. But the minute it starts to cool, then it starts coating your mouth with like chalkiness. So if you want to enjoy a fattier, more unctuous rib, eat it really hot. Eat it right off the grill, like burning your fingers hot, and it's super enjoyable, and I really like it that way. But like I said, if you leave it on a plate, taking pictures for 5 minutes, and bring it outside and have everyone finish their beers before they eat it, like, it's no good. Like, you got to eat them hot. So, yeah, I just want to mention that. It's actually a pretty enjoyable way to enjoy or to have deer fat.
Nice. Yeah. Shots. Hot, yeah. Shots of deer fat.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on. Do you want to do the first brisket recipe, the brisket bacon?
Sure, yeah. So this one is from Alan Burgo, who's known as the Forager Chef. And he uses that, once again, that kind of front piece of brisket, the
point
off of the chest or the breast. and he makes a type of bacon out of it, which is pretty interesting. You can use the kind of flat rib meat for it as well. But he basically creates a... rubs like a cure. So you're rubbing like spices and sugar and salt and pink curing salt or preg powder.
So it'd be your equilibrium cure.
Yes. And then he's letting that chill out for a couple days, probably in a vacuum sealed bag. And then he just basically smokes it. Smokes it for about 3 or 4 hours or until tender at 225 degrees Fahrenheit. He recommends using a steam pan underneath, which will create a lot more moisture inside the vessel or the container that you're smoking it in. And he also recommends, instead of cooking it like regular pork bacon where you're frying slices, he likes to dice it and cook it more like pancetta. And that's a pretty cool way to have like another cured deer product. And one of the pretty unique uses for this cut that most people just grind up. So I thought that was pretty cool.
And I'll talk a little bit about this. This is another, it's a Jesse Griffiths recipe, who, as many of you know, I'm a big fan. But it's on the Meat Eater website, because if you watched episode 3 of season 10 of Meat Eater, Jesse cooks it there, and it's a Texas-style venison belly roulade. And so roulade is a German preparation of some different cuts where you're using a thinner cut of meat and you're rolling it with a filling and you're basically braising it until it's like fall apart. But you then like cross cut it and you're getting these cool little discs of like meat and yummy goodness inside. So for those that may not know, there's a very heavy presence of German culture in Texas. And I'm guessing that this is likely a fusion of sorts of that. So I like, too, that he opens it up with the chef notes of saying, you know, that this portion of the boneless rib meat is usually in the grind pile or just discarded. He likes to cook it for a long time. And then even add in bacon, sharp mustard, pickles, onion, all those things. Like those are really traditionally what you see in a traditional roulade. Is you've got like bacon or prosciutto, you've got a like kind of German style mustard, you've got pickles, and then slices of onion. So those really tasty on its own. I do like Jesse's version of this where he. He takes basically the big side of a belly, which is, he's saying, about 14 to 20 inches. And then he's adding bacon, coarse grain mustard, pickled jalapenos. He's using olive oil or lard. You use carrots, flour, a stock. And that's going to kind of create your base for the sauce that you're going to braise it in. And he lays everything out flat and makes it, if you think about rolling sushi is the easiest way I can and picture this, of like you lay it all on one side and then you roll it up tight and you tie it with butcher's twine, and then you're gonna put it in a Dutch oven after you've made your sauce with the carrots and your other aromatics and your flour for your roux and all that, and then you're going to bring all that liquid to a simmer and you're going to put the roulade in there and you're going to let it cook for about 5 to 7 hours. And then you spoon the sauce over the top once it's done and slice thickly against the grain. And you will have a tasty roulade, which is phenomenal. And I think that's a great thing to do with the flat portion of the brisket, off of an animal, because you've got this big section to sort of roll up and then cut into roll little like rolled sections, which also too is very visually appealing. It's a cool process for people to see if you're doing like a party or a gathering, and it's a great way to use cuts that people are likely not going to cook independently. So I think overall, looking at these sort of five recipes are a great foundation for ways in which to cook these two cuts that aren't commonly cooked. I would say if you're going to dive into this, use these methods, use the preparation methods, maybe take some variations. They can definitely, both these cuts can handle a lot of spice. They can handle a lot of bold flavors. They can handle a lot of really cool sauces. So you can play around with both and see. And I think you're really going to be excited at what you can find and what you can come out with. Definitely encourage everybody to try to use as much as they can. I'll kick it over to you, Adam, for last thoughts or alibis.
Sure. I was thinking there's no need to approach your deer doing the same thing on both sides. So say you have two sides where you have a loin and a rib, and it's a good opportunity to try different things with it. So maybe on the one side, just remove your back strap or your loin, boneless. And then on the other side, do a bone-in one with a rib chopper. You're actually taking part of that rib and leaving it attached to the spine bone and having like a kind of a tomahawk chop or whatever. On one side, maybe grind the rib meat. On the other side, do a roll. Or keep a couple racks. Like, there's no need to do your deer all in the same way. You have different sides, so it's a good opportunity to play around and try new things. And it means that even if you try something new and you didn't like it, you don't have to do your entire deer like that. You know, do one side the way you know and you've always done it, and try something new on the other side. It's a great opportunity to do so. So I think that next time you're doing your deer, try to approach it like that and see what you can come up with.
It's one thing we've started teaching in sort of our pig camps is that before people go out and start butchering their own pigs, we ask them to go through the cookbooks that we use, which we use the hog book for the pig camp. And we have them go through there and like pick out some recipes they want to cook with some specialty cuts, because then we'll teach them how to get those specialty cuts off the animal, like the rib chops, or, you know, we'll teach them how to break down the rib sections or do, you know, different things. And we ask them to create a list and take the list with them out to the butchering area. And I think I would encourage a lot of people to do that. Like, before you start processing your deer, like, go through and think about what cool things you want to try with it. Or if you want to do the same old, that's fine too. But, like, get a plan in your head before you go out and you start butchering, because it's going to make it easier at the end of the day to go through these cuts and really understand what you can do with them if you want to be creative. So that's my last thought as well. So I thank everybody for listening. Look forward to talking with you again here pretty soon. We're going to get our guests back on the show. We're going to get some more fun topics as well, some crew chats. And then, as always, if you've got topics or things you want to hear about, you know, message us on social media. I'm on Instagram. Harvesting Nature's on Instagram. Adam's on Instagram. We're always available. We'll have our show notes will be available online with this episode, so you can get links to all these recipes. You can get links to our website as well. And then make sure that whatever podcast platform you're listening to, punch that 5-star button, leave us a review, tell us we're doing right, or, you know, tell us we're doing wrong. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.
Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern, presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.